Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The room has become slightly warmer, which is of great help to the frog in one's throat. I should like to thank Vibeke and Gert Elise for inviting me to contribute to this event. I must say the invitation came out of the blue, and from someone I hadn't met or didn't know anything about. And I imagined we'd be sitting round a table, four or five people, in an intimate discussion in a library somewhere. So I didn't imagine that it is a highly organized and substantial event. I think, as Vanessa has pointed out, because I'm one of the dinosaurs in this field of the debates over what art can do and can't do, and whether art is a form of thinking, whether it produces knowledge, non-knowledge, how we would understand the curatorial process, how we would understand what curating might be, is there something such as curatorial knowledge from China to Brazil to Africa to Europe. This has been debated all over the show, and I've participated or been privileged to, or maybe have been a bit of a victim in it all, I don't know. So it's not my interest really to go through this archaeology, which goes really back quite a long time into an earlier phase of thinking around these questions at Goldsmiths College and then developing them under the newer horizons of Bologna in Sweden. I want to join the story where I was invited to contribute to, and where Vibeke actually asked me to join the story. Is art today, is art a form of knowledge production, and is this production in some way a counter practice, or is it an entirely commodified practice? I thought the question sounded, on the one hand, a little bit old-fashioned, but at the same time was a challenge. What would we mean by commodified knowledge today? And how does this term undergo change over time? That what we mean by the commodification of art, or whether art as a form of knowledge production is being commodified, undergoes, I think, a different interpretation in different contexts or different configurations of factors. And we are in a very particular configuration, and I felt that Vibeke had put her finger on this, that there is a particular constellation of factors and forces today in which this question becomes significant and meaningful to explore all over again. How to make sense of the notion of the commodification of art as knowledge production. However, as part of this archaeology, I should mention straight away that for me, from the very outset, it wasn't about knowledge production in a straightforward way, but knowledge production as a kind of non-knowledge. Now, this sounds paradoxical, and to some extent it does overlap, as many people have noted, with notions of a negative theology. And I will not hesitate to say that there are inspirations here from the writings of the Buddha through to the writings of Meister Eckhart, the great Buddha of medieval Germany. These thinkers have played a great role in trying to understand the retinal and the potential of the retinal in producing a kind of knowledge which we cannot give total positive form to, that we can only simply describe in terms of saying it is neti, 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 the words of the Buddha, not this, not that, not this. There is this negative theology, I must admit from the beginning, present in the notion of non-knowledge. But it doesn't end there, because if we turn either to Adorno or to the work of Deleuze, Deleuze speaks of a non-conceptual conceptualization. Now, what could such a paradox mean? That art gives us a non-conceptualized conception of the world and of experience. So this non-conceptual conceptual is of interest to me in the notion of non-knowledge, or the Sanskrit term avidya. Enough, however, of going back to older texts. I must then distinguish the use of the word production in about 10 or 15 years ago. It was important to introduce the word production in order to question the notion that the university and the academy is all about knowledge transfer. So one of the big contrasts is, and challenges that is set up, is the contrast between production of knowledge and the fact that the university feels, the academy feels, knowledge is there already made. All we have to do is recruit students to come to these institutions and we will transfer the knowledge to them. So this master-disciple, master-pupil relationship, this hierarchical relationship was questioned in the early use of the notion production. The second connotation to the use of production against transfer is that production shouldn't only be understood in the industrial sense, producing according to a template or a protocol, but production as generation, production as that spasmic ejaculation which produces newness, that orgasmic coming into being of something different and something new, that spasm of newness, that spasm of creativity is what is signaled in this generative notion of production as opposed to the idea of production and reproduction. However, I would say that if those are the connotations around the term knowledge production, then today the problem is not so much with whether we understand that as non-knowledge, avidya, xenoepistemics, the generative force, but that we should genuinely understand that there is a problem with knowledge production, but call that the problem with the productivity principle that has come to govern the universities and the academies. The productivity principle, which is production for the sake of production, production for the sake of keeping up certain levels and rates of, as it were, delivery. And that is, I think, something quite different from the notion of spawning and producing and, as it were, creating. So I think this, your notion of commodification, helped to distinguish between what we must try to identify today as a productivity principle, which has come to take hold of our institutions and our colleges and universities, as opposed to the more creative notion of bringing into being. The second point is that though I'm largely speaking of the visual arts, I mean the arts in general, if that doesn't sound too imperialist a claim to make. Secondly, I also mean by that curating. And while Matthew very charmingly produced an idea of the curatorial, which made my heart sink, but the charm with which he produced it, of course, was deeply seductive. And as an argument, very lovely to look at, but I'm afraid a little bit out of kilter with how one might understand that there are many types of curatorial practice, that we shouldn't forget the diversity of practices that we are dealing with, both in art practice and in curatorial practices. There's classical curatorial practice, there's canonical curatorial practice, there's contemporary curatorial practice. And in contemporary curatorial practices, there are those who want to simply show works, manage them, and put them into some sort of window-dressed relationship to the public. But there are others who see curatorial practice as a form of knowledge production, that the curatorial knowledge produced is over and above the sum of the works in that particular constellation that the curator brings together, that that is a new space of knowledge that opens up with certain kinds of curating. And to that I would add that in fact what art history fails to do, what art criticism fails to do, what philosophy fails to do, often contemporary curatorial practice has been able to do, to open up new areas of thinking, new epistemic objects. And I take, for example, the whole area of what we call the understanding of the post-colonial world and the critique of the Eurocentric, that in moving us out of the Eurocentered notion of the world, art and the aesthetic and the political, often curators took the lead in opening out these as subjects that had to be explored, examined and scrutinized. So I do see some very creative elements to the processes of curating, and I do know that in our minds we generally think of curating as some sort of cocktail affair, but I think that is an image of the past. There is a substantive analytical force that comes into being with certain kinds of curating, which we must understand and acknowledge. And to some extent, if we even look at traditional literature, and if we think of Warburg in the Bilderatlas as a curator who is actually stitching together, literally taking a stitch from one image, taking the thread across the room and stitching it to a particular image, then unraveling the image and making totally different stitches across the room, which will be echoed in Marcel Duchamp's famous stringed up room in which you could not experience the works because the thread across the room was such a tangle and such a web that in fact it closed out any normal kind of viewing. So these are extraordinarily important, as it were, models that we might turn to, early models. We might also think of Walter Benjamin in his notion of the constellation as a curator, that in constellating certain texts, certain ideas, a curatorial event produces a new relationship between bodies of idea and bodies of experience, and that is what the curatorial event is about and the new knowledge and new experience it produces. In relationship to that, almost exactly at the same time as Walter Benjamin was writing the fateful Arcades Project, almost at the same time in England, an equivalent writer, Humphrey Jennings, was writing Pandemonium, which is the English equivalent of the Arcades Project, surprisingly produced almost at the same time, but far less celebrated outside the English-speaking world. And so Pandemonium essentially refers firstly to Humphrey's references to the transition from an old feudal society to the coming of the industrial age in Britain in particular, and in curating texts and images which form the basis of the Pandemonium work, we see again how the curatorial act produces a new body of knowledge and produces and has a very active and creative role in its very essence, as it were. I wanted to start with looking at, so maybe these words, know-how and know-how, you've probably glanced at some of my scribblings around this sort of subject, and I don't think we need to look at it again. I simply wanted to move on to look at the larger scene in which the question of the commodification of knowledge is being posed. And this is a scene from the riots in England earlier last year in the summer, a scene of of an event which we are still analyzing and for which all the given answers do not at the moment fit. We cannot see these riots as something that we can pin onto a particular gender. It wasn't only men, surprisingly a large number of women took part in it, which is something new. We could not pin it onto those terrible immigrants and blacks who live in our cities, who are always ready to riot and live in ghettos. It wasn't. There might have been a streak of that, but no. The millionaire's daughter took her father's motor car and drove up to London in order to join the riots, in order to participate in looting and plundering. The word loot comes from Sanskrit and Hindi. It enters the English language in the 18th century. And loot essentially is a highly transcendental spiritualist word in the Indian setting, where it means, oh, the divine one, loot my heart, loot my human emotions and make me divine. This word then switches over to the cleansing of Bengal in particular across a whole century of looting in India, which then in many ways we have to bear in mind as something that is echoed in these particular riots now in post-imperial, post-colonial Britain. It comes on the heels of about 30 years of what Mrs. Thatcher had initiated and what came to be called the creativity of capitalism. Capitalism which had kind of seen its demise, as it were, by the 70s, is given a new lease of life as it is reinvented. And this creativity of capitalism largely draws, on the one hand, from the Chicago School of Monetarist Finance, but also from older economic models such as the Vienna School, and largely Schumpeter's work on economics being cycles of creation and cycles of destruction. In many ways, it's hard not to see how the Schumpeterian model of construction, destruction, and creation in economics does not to some extent echo the Dada model of creativity and the aesthetic experience being an act of destruction and dissolution, and from it emerging a new cycle of creation. But I would say that this association of Dada, to speak of Dada capitalism, is in many ways really to speak of a pseudo relationship between the aesthetic and the economics. But we should bear in mind to what extent the knowledge produced by Dadaism figures heavily as a model through which we try to understand the cycles of economics today, cycles of destruction and creation. So here is a very powerful example of aesthetics and art producing an analytical model, quite contrary to what we might expect of it, which is then used to interpret and describe the cycles of destruction, the boom and bust, as it were, of capitalism today. However, the main point for us is to see that this creativity of capitalism largely suggests the emergence of a view of the world which we would call an open system, as an, describe it as an open system. Maybe other systems which we dismiss as closed systems, cultures or cultures that are completely sealed and self-sealing and self-contained are not all that closed, but we should speak of them as relatively open or relatively closed systems. And one of the larger factors that we need to bear in mind in just trying to understand this larger landscape of ideas, the atmosphere in which the riots take place, and in which the question of commodities, commodification emerges, is that we also move away from the notion of a universe that has already been scripted and written up, that there will be no change in the universe. The cosmos has all been outlined and a master script exists. This sort of neo-Darwinian thinking is challenged in that great work of 1907 by Bergson, Creative Evolution, where he says nothing, in fact, is closed, that the whole of the evolution of the cosmos remains open, and it's a constantly creative process. So creativity is now being used in a very, very particular way as being part and parcel of our life, part and parcel of our world. Our world can't be seen as dead, inert, and as it were, unchanging, but as a creative force in itself. In fact, maybe we should sum this up as the notion of the survival of the fittest, which was a phrase not quite used by Darwin. Darwin only reluctantly accepted this phrase to describe his theory of natural selection for the sixth edition of his work. It's more a Spencerian phrase, survival of the fittest, an evolutionary ladder. We know where we're all going. The universe is knowable. Against this, we have the idea of the survival of the prettiest. Again, an aesthetic model. The survival of the prettiest, or as James Joyce put it, so evil of the prettiest. This evil seduction that prettiness brings into the world, that you cannot have an A to Z movement. You're constantly seduced in different directions by the beauty of the thing, by the attractiveness of the thing, rather than this kind of fit for purpose and fit for life. The odd thing here, of course, is sadly, today in English, the way the word fit is used contradicts a little bit of what I'm saying, because when we say, where are the fit ladies, where are the fit guys, we don't mean it in the Darwinian sense, we mean it in the sense that where are the attractive sexy guys, or where are the attractive sexy women. So there is a little bit of a language issue here, but that we need to bear in mind. But please, the point is simply this. Against this backdrop of pan-creativity, of everything being creative, we find the emergence of a particular ideology that claims that capitalism itself is a creative force, and it is the intrinsically creative force, the life force itself is capitalist and creative. And from this, we will see the shift from the first modernity into the second modernity, from industrial to what we roughly and perhaps wrongly call post-industrial society. This transition is also about creativity, and that's a bit I just want to look at. But before that, to look at the opposition to the state of education, or as education heads towards becoming more and more a matter of producing certain packaged products, as it were, which could be bought and sold easily, that the university increasingly is becoming a factory offering modules, units, and it's no more the experience of a social educational kind, that is increasingly frowned on as a law of productivity, as the productivity principle takes over the universities and colleges, and a principle of efficiency in the delivery of those products comes to govern the scene. So these demonstrations were organized by the students. They go right back to now a year ago, or even 2009, I think. And the years go by so fast. And they are the why I was interested, because these were largely the art students who were unusually at the head of the protests and the demonstrations, the Slade School of Art, once associated with the English liberal establishment, is the school that leads with the symposium on the state of education and the commodification of education. And in this demonstration of the books, I rather found an odd constellation of some of my favorite books, and this is why I've chosen this. Adorno's Negative Dialectics, hidden behind is my hobby horse, James Joyce's Ulysses. And then Unto His Last, one of the great works written by Ruskin, which was almost a riposte to Marx, but fades away from our view and is generally policed and contained as an art criticism work, but it is a work on political economy and which refers back to those very troubling and extremely interesting passages in the Bible, that is Matthew 20, where workers and work, labor and creativity is meditated on. And Ruskin takes this particular gospel and writes Unto His Last. It was a deep inspiration to Mahatma Gandhi, who immediately translated the work when he came across it, when somebody gave it to him in a vegetarian restaurant in Johannesburg at the turn of the last century. I'm deeply surprised that there was a vegetarian restaurant in South Africa at the time. The last work, Pip by Griffiths, is a fantastic use of contemporary and colloquial English, and I think fits in with one of the themes that this particular symposium is concerned with. Is language is language given to us, or is language something we have to create and invent at every turn? We have to invent a language, and we have to invent a methodology for art research and art thinking. It's not a ready-made language given to us, and this is something that we can often fail, and hence the great suspicion around research in art and knowledge production through art, when that process is reduced to simply borrowing and pilfering the language of philosophy, the language of anthropology, the language of sociology, rather than feeling that we are inspired and informed by the language of philosophy, of anthropology, of history. But the responsibility remains that we have to invent a language through which we are able to articulate the issues of the experience of knowledge given to us through art. At the intersection then of these themes of creativity, as creativity is being used to interpret and describe the world as a whole, natural processes, physical, the physical universe, the economic universe, and the claims now shift to the industrial universe, as this creativity is being claimed for all these terrains of human life and existence, it intersects with the notion of commodification. And this intersection is what I was hoping we could look at very quickly through this diagram that I made for the Pandemonium Biennale in Göteborg. The idea is that we live in a time we call roughly globalization, but a time of the rise of the global assembly line, that know-how is produced in a particular way at one end of the assembly line, and it passes to the other end of the assembly line where dirty manufacture takes place. And many of these elements we would have to see in quite another map. But I wanted us to just note how from this very random kind of organization of the atelier, where bicycles were made, and bicycles surprisingly form the prototype for mass production of motor cars, which is why it is so interesting that one of the first ready-mades of Marcel Duchamp was the bicycle wheel. And his interest in industrial ready-mades is in many ways signaled, although later thinkers were to give a rather spiritualistic reading to this bicycle wheel and say it was a Buddhist prayer wheel and all such other fanciful ideas. We can't stop them from thinking it. Least of all, Marcel Duchamp never wanted to stop anybody's interpretation about his works, whether he liked it or not. But I think essentially it comes out of his close connections with the Levasseur family. And then, of course, from that emerges the first mass-produced motor car, the Ford T model, and then the A model, which becomes the industrial model of production right up to about 1950. But already by 1950, the Ford system had reached its ceiling of productivity and efficiency, that this form of commodity production had begun to reach its full limits. And there is, for this reason, I hesitate to use the word post-industrial or post-Ford, because there is involved in the story this bit, the Japanese side of things, that in Japan had emerged another model quite different from the model of the Ford system, the Toyota model, or what was called lean production. And in lean production, there was a fierce challenger to the Ford system. Because Japan was defeated and was rising in such a powerful way, the United States and Japan could have ended up in a protectionist war with each other, and eventually they came to an understanding to bring their knowledge together with regard to the Ford system and the lean production system to invent a new system which we generally refer to by a nickname, the mean machine. The mean machine is productivity at its full throttle, as it were. The Ford system largely was based on the idea that you stood there as a robot and things passed in front of you. The work cycle was extremely short because the mind has a capacity to daydream and wander away and do all sorts of wonderful things that it's not supposed to do. And to regulate it on the factory belt, you needed to reduce the work cycle to something very specific. So I call this a mindless situation. The mind had to be emptied to focus on this job. This mindless could be, again, interpreted as a kind of Buddhist state of mind, though it might it might be seen as a little bit of a naughty joke to say that. But this mindlessness must be contrasted to a system that questioned mindlessness, and that is the system that emerged in this part of the world, in Sweden, in this little place called Uddevalla, where we move away from mindless production in the search for a more humanized, less robotic kind of production, in which we are not standing in front of a conveyor belt. Thank you. I'll move on faster. Not standing in front of a conveyor belt, but we are around a table, and the motor car is almost a sculpture around which whole groups of workers work together in a joint endeavor of the production of the vehicle. This is a mindful state of making. So mindless compared to mindful. But of course, the mean machine takes elements from both. It is said that the Americans gave a very bad report about Uddevalla and had it shut down, really. And of course, at the same time, the Swedish government seemed to have lost the stomach to sustain the project, and it was wrapped up after 4 years of rather fruitful experiments in work and creativity and mindfulness. So a meta-mindful situation in the mean machine, the new production that we come across, this mix between Ford and Toyota, and the lean production method, is all about the worker now being put in front of the production system, in which the worker is given a certain mindful role. He or she must keep an eye for how the whole system could be improved, how little hitches and glitches in the system would become occasions through which one could see how you could solve a problem. So the onus is being put on the worker to become an intelligent, not a robotic person, but an intelligent thinker whose creative powers, whose creative observation and diagnostic powers are being drawn on by the system, and the worker is drawn in into the role of being an innovator who's constantly expected to come up with new innovations to improve the system, but it's all in the interests of the productivity principle. So here is creativity now, written into the very heart of the production system. Where does that leave creativity in art? How would we distinguish between these different forms of creativities that I've tried very hurriedly to map and to see as the backdrop to the crisis over education, over knowledge production, and over the PhD, as it were, in visual arts? I'll skip that and leave it as a question that we might want to explore. I'll close by just saying that deep in the Grundrisse, Marx makes an interesting comment. In the notes leading up to the production of Das Kapital, he asks, quoting an English economist, Nassau Senior, he says, "Who is the real producer and creator? Is it the person who makes the piano, or is it the person who plays the piano?" Marx, after Duchamp, which is the title of our seminar in China, introduces a third element. Who is the real producer? Is it the listener of the piano? Producer, the man with the hammer or the woman with the hammer, the person who plays and composes, the conceptual creator, or the so-called passive listener who has to be present for the work, as it were, to be conveyed and interpreted. Ruskin goes on to add to this, and Marx comes up with a very strange thing. He says it can't really be anybody except the maker of the piano, the person who actually nails wood and works with the saw, because only that labor produces and extends capital. Of course, the player of the piano adds to consumption in an intelligent way and therefore is feeding back into production. But, he says, is it any different than a madman who produces delusions? A madman's delusions are productive, but we don't see that as productive in the way we speak of production. Well, perhaps Marx was living in a pre-therapeutic age when he didn't realize how the madman's delusions would begin to produce the whole industry of pharmaceuticals, medication, and medicalization of the mind, that there too we would have delusions and the mad person as being deeply a creative force in the economy of contemporary post-industrial societies. And of course, Ivan Illich has a lot of interesting things to say, just as Ruskin and Gandhi. I'll skip them. My last bit then is, who then is the producer? Is it Polyander, the public expert who's able to speak and teach and be a tutor and supervise PhDs and interpret the world of art? Is it Epistemon, the technician, Or is it Eudoxus, the idiot? The idiot here mustn't be understood, mustn't be read in the contemporary English way in which we say idiot, meaning a silly fool or a denunciatory phrase. I should have perhaps typed it up in the Irish spelling, E-E-J-I-T, Egypt. Egypt here is an affectionate term of someone who is so eccentric and quirky and different that we almost have a kind of endearing view of this idiosyncratic mentality. So it is the idiolectic, idiosyncratic person. Maybe the contemporary form of that is the much laughed at figure of the geek. The geek who is socially awkward, doesn't have the smoothness of the public expert, and doesn't have, and still has the technician's skills, and is largely seen as a bit of an idiot, but is also idiolectic. So the artist, producer, the knowledge producer as auteur or as idiot, the knowledge producer in art as the ethnographer, the knowledge producer in art as the concept in engineer or inventor, and increasingly the pressure in the creative industries to see the artist as a knowledge producer who is the entrepreneur. So you can see how many definitions of what is art and art knowledge and its effects in society at play in our time. The entrepreneurial model being perhaps at once the most interesting, but perhaps also the one that is most imprisoning ultimately and most trapping. That on the one hand it suggests the artist can lift himself or herself up by his or her own bootstraps, self-organize, do things in the world, produce knowledge, produce objects, and survive through them. But on the other hand, it is also the business model that our Prime Minister in England would deeply love us all to kind of follow, to be the good little capitalist. Against it all, I suggest then, against these work regimes, a honey-steeped indolence is to be sought, a laziness, a kind of idleness against the productivity principle. I feel it was the nemesis and it was a real comeback that Marx's son-in-law should have written the Manifesto on Idleness, that this great thinker of production, productiveness, productivity, which tips over into productivity, for all the tremendous wisdom and insight that we've gained in examining the production model in Marx, should produce a son-in-law who should say, I want to be lazy, and the world should be lazy. And of course, this is perhaps hinted at in the ideal of the communist utopia, which Marx, wise man that he was, doesn't give us very many details of what this communist utopia would look like. The ones that perhaps did come into being turned out to be a bit of a nightmare, to say the least. But in his utopia, he says, reading in the morning, walking at midday, and then perhaps a little bit of fishing in the evening. I didn't like it, being a vegan, fishing. But the idea of an indolent life related to the notion of the meaning of sleep as opposed to mindfulness, work, meta-mindfulness. And I can only refer to the work in the Biennale of Inga Svala Thorsdottir, whose wonderful work on sleep evoked for us this possibility of another regime of living based on the equal importance to the three dimensions of consciousness that the East has always recognized: waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Whereas in the West, in the productivity model of things, sleep is a waste of time. So there is a call for us to rethink the notion of indolence against the kinds of commodifications that I hope I have very hurriedly and somewhat carelessly sketched. for this presentation. Now, thank you.